here, Sal Rodriguez.
I thought you were going to let that whole song play. That's what I thought your plan was.
I think I was waiting for Nick to fade it. I think he was waiting for me to give him the sign to fade it. So thank God we didn't sit here for the next 4 minutes.
Chris, can we apologize to our listeners?
That's
we've
the
never
first
started
thing we're
this
do.
Late. It was our fault. We blame nobody. Nick Chacon is a professional. He was here on time. Our guest today was here before us. It was us, folks. The problem was us.
I accept full responsibility with an assist from inclement weather.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know what they say, that stereotype about people in Los Angeles, we cannot drive in the rain. We just can't.
It is so alien to us. Let's be honest. I mean, when's the last time it rained before today?
Maybe,
last year?
Yeah, exactly. You know, they even made a song about it. It never rains in Southern California. They did that song for a reason. It really is so infrequent. It freaks us out.
It literally took us twice as long to get here as it
took us
does.
Twice as long to get here. We had to get off the freeway and then get back on the freeway. Yeah. Chris had to dump me off
right
in the front. I had to run up. Really, so once again, registered air offenders apologizes to our loyal listeners. I'm sure when you guys heard that theme song, you were able to breathe a sigh of relief.
People were angry.
They were. The people started actually tweeting about how pissed off.
Emails were flooding in. The phones were ringing off the hook. Speaking of phones, 800-893-9562 is our number. So go ahead and give us a call if you can or care to. As always, I'm Chris Z, accompanied by Sal Rodriguez. As always, we have a rock solid lineup. As always, we have a brand new guest for our listeners. We got Troy Conrad today.
Yep.
What else we got? We got.
I'm excited about this guy. This guy, Troy Conrad, he does all kinds of stuff. And he's an award-winning filmmaker. He's a comedian. He's a satirist. Worked with Paul Prevenza. Very excited to have Troy Conrad on the show today.
He produces a show on Pacifica Radio with David Feldman, which is really cool because David Feldman has been one of my favorite comics for I don't even know how long since I saw him on a short-lived television show that they used to broadcast late on Saturday nights. It was filmed somewhere in either Santa Monica or San Diego, and it was about three or four big-name comics doing about 7 minutes each. Just, you know, good, clean stand-up, and I saw him on, and I thought he was just a hell of a comic, smart guy, and I know that he went on to write for Dennis Miller for many seasons. And actually, have you ever worked with him at the Promenade?
No. Well, yeah. maybe, you know, because also Troy Conrad has also worked with Eddie Pepitone, and I have worked with him at the Promenade as well.
Yeah.
When I say worked with, I mean pissed him off as host of the show at the Promenade. That's what I mean by worked with. Maybe we'll get into that. I'll talk to Troy about that.
Are you sure, though? Because Eddie Pepitone has that kind of nature that he's, you know, the kind of guy who could easily be mistaken for being pissed off at any given time.
No. Believe me, I'll go into this about how when I used to host, I thought of me hosting a show as it's the Sal show. That's what I used to think. So I would do like these like 10 minutes between each comic, and Eddie Pepitone was visibly irritated.
So it's the Sal show, and these are my guests.
Exactly. Hey, we got a good, as though we don't need any more curveballs today. Apparently, we have a phone call. Nick, are they still there? Let's take this phone call real quick. Chris, what do you say?
Caller, are you there?
Hello.
Hey, how are you? This is Chris Z. I'm here with my co-host, Sal Rodriguez, registered air offenders.
Hey, Chris Z and Sal Rodriguez. This is Jeff Sparks calling from Moreno Valley.
Well, hello there, Mr. Jeff Sparks. How's it going in Moreno Valley?
It's going okay. The rain is nice. Enjoying the rain. A little bloated, though, from some chicken tamales earlier. But, you know, it's getting a little better.
Well, you know what? This is, you know, we have apparently some a following in the Philippines, in Argentina, and also Pakistan, and now
wow.
Moreno Valley in the Inland Empire.
It is nice to know that somebody locally is listening.
Exactly. People who actually may recognize our faces. What's going on? What are you doing out there?
Oh, man, I've been actually working with some old guys out here at the park that I live in. I'm working on a YouTube show called Old Guys Rule.
Yeah? You know what I thought about that recently? Because I saw a guy with that T-shirt. I saw a guy with the Old Guys Rule T-shirt.
Yeah, the title is probably going to change because I think it is trademarked, but that's the title we're working with right now. But having fun with it, though. It should be up on YouTube in January sometime.
So your shoot didn't get rained out, is what you're saying?
I'll be shooting Warped again here soon. I'll be in town.
Warped, yeah. Is that going to be on YouTube?
That's going to be on YouTube as well. I don't know if you guys have seen the funded YouTube channels. This, the one I'm talking about, the one we're doing, is not funded, unfortunately.
I understand YouTube is producing funded original content now.
Yeah, Justin Lin has a channel. I've been following some shows on that, and his show has his shows are more Asian influence, but they're still, you know, really fun. And the Russo brothers have actually done a couple shows. And the assistant to the Russo brothers, Ari Costa, has done a show called Mother Lover that's really good. It's been picked up for a second season. So I guess there is some little bit of money, but they're hoping to get some development deals out of being on YouTube and, you know, worked with Workaholics, those guys on Comedy Central.
Yeah, YouTube recently approached Sal and I about not picking up our show.
No, you know what? Okay. Honestly, Jeff, there's a lot of exciting things going on here, not only with Registered Ear Offenders, but also with Skid Row Studios. And we're going to have some big announcements pretty soon. So make sure you stay tuned. We appreciate you calling. Hey, listen, is there anything that you want to go ahead and let our listeners know about? Any website or Facebook page you want to plug right now?
Right now, just Sparks 1138 on YouTube. That's going to be the channel where the shows are going to be. But that's about it for now. I just wanted to tune in and see what you guys are up to. I hope the journey has been good on internet radio for you guys.
It's been really great. And let me tell you something, Jeff.
For the last year, I don't know if you know the poor man from K-Rock.
Sure.
And he's kind of still at it, but now again he's unemployed. It's kind of sad, but
well, you know what? If he's
you guys are going strong.
If Poor Man's a friend of yours, maybe you guys want to come out and be on the show sometime.
You know, I think Poor Man would maybe come on the show and say hello to you guys. And
nice.
He's in New York right now, so it'd have to be like a Skype situation or something.
Okay, we'll work it out. Hey, listen, Jeff, we really appreciate you calling, man.
Yeah, you guys keep it up.
Thanks, man.
All righty.
Take care.
Later.
Well, great. We got some fanship following. You know, one thing I just wanted to mention real quick. I wanted to say this on the air. And Chris, I wanted to wait until I was on the air to mention this. Everything's going great, not only with our show as a team, but for me personally, after 8-9 years of pounding the pavement out there, I've been in over 20 commercials, 25 corporate videos and all that. It seems that I've finally gotten a break and landed my first Taft-Hartley SAG National. We will be shooting next Wednesday. I will now be a member of the Screen Actors Guild /AFTRA. And could make some big bucks.
Yeah, that's the union where they pay you really well and you return that money in dues immediately.
Exactly.
Okay.
Let me tell you something, man. I spoke with my agent and this may be some pretty decent big bucks. You know what, Chris? I'm going to treat you to dinner.
When?
When I get paid.
You know that this is on record, right?
This is on record, so man. You know what, Chris?
You'll
I'm saying on record right now, when I get paid, I'm treating you to the sushi restaurant of your choice.
Wow, man. I appreciate that.
Yeah, man. I'm excited.
It seems that everything is coming up roses for just about everybody I know, sans me.
No, man. Listen, man. Where I go, you go. So believe me, any success I have, Chris and I have promised each other, If he gets a big break, I'm on his coattails. If I get a big break, he's on my coattails. We're in this together, man.
Yeah, yeah. We're in it to win it. If we go down, then we go down together. And that's comforting because Sal's about the only person in the world who I can, you know, who I feel that way about.
I'm going to cry, Chris.
Anyway,
hey, man, we are running late big time. Let's go ahead and get into our show. Why don't we just go ahead and jump right into our first segment of When We Peaked? What do you say?
Yeah, let's do it. Go ahead. I'll start this off here.
Go ahead, man.
When I was about 21 years old, maybe 20, 21 years old, I was still working. I was still living at home. I went to community college. I was getting ready to go away to university, and I started delivering pizzas, which normally is like, you know, the step maybe before rock bottom or something. But for a kid living at home, paying no rent.
For a kid, delivering pizzas is quite respectable.
Yeah, right. And here's the best part about it. I was living in South Florida. There was a community just west called Weston. Now, originally, this community was founded as like kind of like a high-end, you know, a suburb, you know, kind of gated complex thing. Some of the Miami Dolphins lived there. It was kind of a big deal. And Papa John's opened, and they hired me as a driver. And Papa John's was a big novelty down there, especially in this little community where there wasn't a whole lot to choose from. It wasn't, you know, like your typical suburb with you know, fast food franchises on every corner. And man, the bucks were rolling in. The phones rang off the hook. And it was such a small community that you could make, the average run took you no more than 20 minutes. So, I mean, over the course of a night, you could rack up a lot of, you know, a lot of quick deliveries. Obviously, it's more lucrative to do a, you know, a 20-minute delivery than it is an hour delivery. So anyway, I had a lot of fun, man. I worked there for about a year. I had an incident where a lady answered the door in a see-through, kind of nighty, and I don't think that she was aware how see-through it was, but yeah, she was gorgeous, man, and I don't know how she didn't notice me staring, because you could actually see the outline of her pubic hair. You could see her nipples and everything, and
it was you're going to tell me that you slept with a pizza recipient housewife, I'm going to freak out.
No, it never, but I did one time go to a house or an apartment where there was like four or five girls, you know, like four or five women actually. And I think I even said something like, hey, is this one of those crazy 80s films where the pizza guy comes in? And they're like, no.
No, it's not.
Okay, then I'm out of here. But I had a lot of fun in that job and I was making good money. And I just liked the fact that, I was so independent. But what happened is the community grew quickly, man. And in the space of a year, other competitors popped up. The community kept growing. And before I knew it, I was driving out to this, this one community that was a good half hour away. So the money started, going down. We started doing less deliveries over the course of a night and stuff. But I just loved it, man. I loved the autonomy, I didn't have to commit to it. It was like a typical shift was 4 or 5 hours long. And sometimes I had quote unquote girlfriend, and what I do is after work, I'd go hang out with my friends. And if I wasn't feeling it, if we weren't having fun, like I'd call her and I'd go, hey, you want to come over? I just got off work. You know what I mean? And she's like, I couldn't wait to get home and talk to you. But really, I had been out carousing with my buddies.
Well, the one thing I just thought about when it comes to these when we peaked moments or segments, rather, can we actually imagine? Well, I could always go back there if I wanted to. Can you go back there? Your parents still live in Florida. You could conceivably move back to Florida and begin delivering pizzas if you wanted to.
And I'm sure my mother would love that.
I mean, really, she would.
Yeah, my mother is, in that respect, we're very Latino. Like, there would be nothing, I think in American culture, it's kind of like, one of the worst things that can happen to you is you have to go pound on your parents' door. But my mother would be ecstatic to have me.
Nice. Just,
for me, I would die. I would die inside if I had to go back and be that guy. Because everybody who's ever worked in a restaurant has worked with that guy who you go like, man, what happened to that guy? Like everybody here is 20, 21, 25 at the oldest. And then there's the 45-year-old guy.
Yeah.
Like my last job, it was Mo. Super nice guy. Apparently he'd been a musician in his younger years or whatever. But you get, 45, suddenly you got a big old pot belly, you're balding. There's no room for you on the rock scene anymore.
It's no different than when I used to work at Bally Total Fitness as a trainer in my early 20s. And then we'd see these new trainers coming in their 40s. We'd be like, wow, what did they do with their lives?
He must have gotten into drugs.
Yeah, exactly.
You assume he got injured.
Yeah, exactly. Like he must have done a whole lot of stupid shit to wind up back here at 40 where I'm at 20.
Yeah, but that was great, man. So I had a girlfriend at the time too who went to the University of Miami. So we never, I didn't have to suffer like most guys in relationships, the kind of overbearing girlfriend who wanted to be with you all the time because she couldn't. She was away most of the time engaging in her studies. And sometimes I'd cruise up there for the weekend, spend, 2 days in her dorm and then get the hell out, get back to having fun,
How old were you at this time?
About 21 years old.
Wow, this is probably one of the latest when we peaked that you've done.
Yeah. I'd say things were even good well into maybe 23, 24 when I was in college writing my own column. But then after that, though, that's when I hit the precipice.
I think that the rain makes you extra depressed. That's what I'm thinking. That's what I gather from you today.
It's not even raining, Sal. Those are my tears.
When I got in the car with you today and I asked how you're doing and you're like, oh, I'm doing pretty good. I didn't buy it. I did not fucking buy it.
I won't lie to you, Sal. You're my friend, but there are some things you don't know about me. You don't know that most nights I drink myself to blackout. This show, if it wasn't for this show is a lifeline. This show is that, whatever you call that fucking thing that you throw people who are drowning.
The lifesaver.
Yeah, because everything else has just ground to a halt.
So you live your life Friday to Friday.
I never heard that expression. But
well, you know how people live their life paycheck to paycheck?
Yeah.
So we live our lives Friday to Friday. Let me get into my when we peaked. I'm going to take you into recent times. Normally when I'm doing when we peaked, hell, I went all the way back to sixth grade on one point. This when we peaked only was 3 years ago when I was invited to do stand-up comedy with the USO, with Chris Z and Debbie Lockhart, and we got to tour the Middle East. Unfortunately, Chris had to bail out and you missed this great opportunity, but I believe you've had subsequent similar opportunities where I did stand-up comedy on an aircraft carrier in the middle of the Persian Gulf, sometimes called the Arabian Gulf, depending on who you talk to. And let me tell you something. I'm not a big patriot. I'm not a nationalist. I'm not a big patriot. But in this very moment, doing stand-up with all those soldiers in front of me, with the big flag waving in front of me, with the view of the ocean from the stage, that was a peak moment for me. Because, the one thing I've realized in the last few years is that whatever you're doing, even right now, for example, you got to imagine, what if this is it? What if this is it? and I'm never going to get any bigger or better than this, I might as well savor it and enjoy it. And let me tell you something, I really did enjoy and savor that. In fact, I savored it so much, I don't even know if my act was good at all. I might have sucked, but it was such a great experience, and I was a patriot for about 20 minutes in the middle of the Persian Gulf on an aircraft carrier.
Was that the ship that they served you lobster and crab?
That's part of it, too. Hell, that's a little add-on. On our final night on the ship, we got to eat with the officers. We got to eat with the ship's captain, and they served us all-you-can-eat giant king crab legs. I never liked crab so much.
Now, Sal and I have discussed this before. I have such a Spartan work ethic that in many cases, it's actually hurt me, like my commitment to honoring my obligations, and that was one example.
Yeah, you had a prior obligation.
The reason I was not there is because I was doing improv theater in Los Angeles, and I had a performance, and I actually left the tour a little early so I could be there. That theater group subsequently folded. The theater was bought by another individual, so that collapsed within months, if not weeks, of that experience. I could have been there with you guys, and instead I was in L.A.
Let me put that in perspective for the listener. Chris had the opportunity to do stand-up comedy for our troops on the Persian Gulf on an aircraft carrier, but instead wanted to do an improv show on Olympic in Los Angeles.
Yeah. Yeah, that's me. That's me. That's me in a fucking nutshell, man. Anyway, listen, we got to move on.
Let's go ahead and get right into our guest. What do you say?
Okay, sounds good.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, you want to go ahead and introduce our guest, Chris?
Yeah, and this is an abridged version of his bio. Troy Conrad is a comic, satirist, and an award-winning filmmaker who's performed at comedy festivals in Dublin, Montreal, Vancouver, Calgary, Melbourne, and Edinburgh. He's the creator and co-producer of the 14-episode TV series Setlist, airing this spring in the UK, and he produces a live version of Setlist monthly at the UCB Theater in Los Angeles. Please welcome our guest for today, Troy Conrad. How you doing, Troy? Take a seat, make yourself comfortable.
Hey,
get
guys,
right up on that mic.
Here.
Oh, I don't got to tell you, you're a radio veteran, right?
Somewhat.
From time to time, I'll dabble in the radio.
Where do you broadcast out of?
Out of Pacifica Radio, KPFK. It's, you know, NPR-like station. It's been around for... This particular studio is where Richard Pryor had a show years ago. Before he became... Bob Marley had a show at this station. That's
so,
a trip.
Are you or have you ever been a communist?
That is... You know what's funny? It is sort of a communist-leaning station. And we get into a little bit of trouble. We're a liberal show... And one of the problems with being that far on the left is you want to start censoring free speech. Like, words are hurtful and we can't offend anybody. So we get in trouble from time to time, but they're very good to us there, and it all works out.
Well, Troy, I would like to welcome you to Registered Ear Offenders, where you can say whatever the fuck you want.
Very nice.
About any fucking race, too.
Yeah, I just listening last. I was at the Ice House last night, and there's a comedian who I like, and he always a lot of his material is social commentary and whatnot. And he was talking about that, about some friend of his who was suggesting that we should eradicate the word or the phrase "chink in the armor" from the English language because you run the risk of offending somebody, even inadvertently, some Asian American who might hear the word "chink" and think you were, and because of his minimal intelligence, think that you were, you know, slighting his race
rather than using it. No. If you're Japanese or Korean, that does not apply to you.
How many American-born Asians you think would even know then?
That what chink refers to Chinese specifically?
Right, I'm aware of that. But what I'm saying is, again, you think in this day and age, it's not it's no longer valued to be an informed individual. It's more important that you react out of ignorance because we've given that clout, we've given that some kind of substance. The fact that somebody's offended, it's somehow a currency these days. Whereas it used to be incumbent upon you to be an educated, informed individual and not take offense to things that aren't meant to offend.
Well, let me tell you something. As an American Mexican in Los Angeles, I am constantly offended. Hey, Troy, tell us about what you did with Eddie Pepitone and Runyon Just Above Sunset.
Oh yeah, well, Eddie Pepitone is a fantastic comic, and he called me one day. His girlfriend Karen Simmons wrote this really fantastic idea for a sketch. It was just going to be a sketch where we shot one day at Runyon, where it's Eddie Pepitone climbing up Runyon as if it's Mount Everest. Takes him 6 days, a Sherpa and an expedition leader. And what happened was Eddie is so damn funny that we shot that day. And I said, you know what? Let's do some stuff tomorrow. And then let's do some stuff on Friday. And then, so we ended up shooting probably 7-8 days there. We set up a tent. We had no permits. We set up a tent inside Runyon Canyon. It turned out fantastic. It took us forever to get it all edited together, but we did this as a series for Funny or Die. And people liked it so much, we sort of had to make it into a little 30-minute feature and put that on DVD. And then we took it to festivals, and we only applied to two festivals. We got into the two festivals, and we won awards at both festivals. So it turned out to be a really great project that just was going to be a sketch.
In terms of content, did you find yourself kind of making it up as you go? Like, hey, let's have it today. He steps on a snake. Or
the entire thing was improvised. Luckily, there was a good outline. I only like to work in that way. I don't like screenplays. I don't like scripted, in the sense that when you have these great performers who can improvise like crazy, like Eddie Pepitone, you don't need a script. They have so many scripts within them that it's a travesty to give them a script, I feel.
Well, you know, Troy, speaking of improvising and not having a script, I'd like to play a clip of where you talk about your show Set List. Nick, hit it, please.
Yeah, Eddie Pepitone is a part of the TV series as well.
Set List is this. Comics walk on stage, they get a set list of very strange words that they've never seen before until the moment they're on stage. And they walk up and act like that's their act. They perform from a set list they've never seen and act like that's what they meant to do.
Post, I think you know a girl is too young for you.
A set list is the little notes a comic has, which is one or two words, a couple words to remind them of what might be 15 minutes of material. It's sort of like a set list for a musician, except that would be song titles. This could just be some odd word that inspires a 15-minute routine. And so for a comedian to get a list of things that could be anything is exciting and daunting at the same time.
That's Paul Provenza right there.
You know, a lot of people aren't really familiar with Nirvana's first album. And I think part of the problem was that they might have been trying to attempt too much. However, later when they re-released the album, it was called The Pencil Case Wang.
It's actually really exciting to see these people who sell out the O2 Arena, you know, see Tim Minchin backstage going, I'm about to go on Set List. I've never been this frightened, you know. That is pretty trippy, but what the great thing about it, aside from any sort of schadenfreude, like how funny that is, the great thing about it is it's a great equalizer. It doesn't matter if you're the most famous comic in the world or you're me or Shore Conrad. There's no difference between you when it comes to Set List.
Chess grandmaster Garry Kasparov says anybody in a profession where they take themselves seriously needs to throw themselves new challenges in order to get better and grow, even if they've reached the pinnacle of their career. And that's kind of what this does. The best comics in the business do it, and they go, oh, I've never experienced this.
I guess it's the equivalent of kind of working out in a gym, but in a weird way, what it calls upon for a comedian to do, it calls upon all these talents and tools and freedom and a certain innocence and a childlike quality to just be able to be funny in the moment about anything.
Comedy goes in so many exciting directions, ladies and gentlemen.
I think that's it.
All right.
A lot of that's visual, so I cut out some of this.
Oh, okay. I was wondering, because I could have sworn I listened to that clip at home that there was an end. There was an official end, I thought.
Yeah, what you can't see are the comics that are performing. They have topics behind them. The last comic was Rich Hall, and his topic on screen, which he didn't see until he turned around and had to act like that was his act, was Frog Jap Kraut Mafia. It makes no sense.
Talk about random. See, I figured you would have stuff like mother-in-law.
No, never. Here's the rule. It can't be anything that has ever in the history of comedy been on any comedian set list, including someone who did an open mic in the middle of Iowa. It can never be something that's ever been even conceived as being on a set list.
And who puts the suggestions in the hat?
Well, there's no hat.
Is there a basket?
Well, there is from the audience, but that's only used sparingly. The real show is done with topics that go on a screen, on a projection screen behind the comics. So Paul Provenza and I write those very carefully and make sure that they're really good, meaty topics, but also meaningless in terms of when you see it, you go, what the hell does that mean? That means nothing. But when you're up in front of an audience, you're going to make it mean something and you're going to make it funny. That's just how the dynamic works.
And does each comic get a different set list?
Yeah. Yeah. They get 5 to 6 topics and everybody gets a different list.
So is there a winner, so to speak?
No. We decided to go in the opposite direction of the crappy competitions that comedy... I don't think you can, with any dignity, turn comedy into a competition. It's an art form, and everybody has a different personality. It's like having a personality contest. It just doesn't... There's so many variables. It's so hard. And usually it just ends up being a popularity contest anyway. So we don't have that sort of scoring or anything. You just get to see comics' brains working. Everyone enjoys that dynamic of like watching someone react in the moment. Their brain is freaking out and you're watching, you know, Robin Williams up there going, wow, he really doesn't know what he's about to say the next second. It's just fascinating to see.
Well, that's what, you know, I like that concept that, yeah, just like you said, you can't turn everything into a contest. And that's why I think beauty contests are such bullshit. Because it's so up for interpretation and debate as to what constitutes beauty or what constitutes comedy, so to speak.
Well, like Troy said, there's too many variables. I think that was well put, because there are certain things that you can measure. You know, who can peel a banana the fastest? You know, you can get 2 bananas that weigh the same and that's it. You know, but whereas something like you said, like a comedy, there is just too many. There's too many different styles. There's too many. And of course, there's perception, you know, the audience themselves. It's a matter of taste. You know?
And that's why I feel much better now. Thank you, Troy, that I've never won a comedy contest, merely been a finalist in several.
Well, I hate the fact. That's why, you know, we comedians typically resent shows like Last Comic Standing,
yes,
because they promote the idea that it's about who's the best or this guy's better than that guy or, you know what I mean? And that's not the case. In fact, years ago, I worked with a guy, Peter Hefty, back in Florida, and for what it was just a real dense crowd. And back then, I had just started out, and I was doing a lot of lowbrow shit. And they thought I was brilliant. He ate shit. And at the end of the night, they're like, "Oh, that should have been you headlining." And I, you know, even at the age of, you know, maybe 23, 24, I had the good sense to tell them, "Hey, look, he had an off night. He belongs up there.
Yeah.
I'm the middle because I'm lucky to be here. He's a veteran headliner. You just caught him on his, you know, his once or twice a year where he didn't blow the roof off the place, you know."
Yeah, and then, you know, then what happens in the contest when there's that night and then someone who's just an amazing legendary, you know how great they are, they have an off night and then they're scored and then they lose this thing. Like, it's just terrible. It helps one or two people's careers and it kind of makes everyone else feel like shit.
Troy, because you work with Paul Provenza, are you and everyone that works with you in Set List obliged to do their version of The Aristocrats?
We do not do The Aristocrats, although I believe that film, he's looking for the company that distributes it went out of business. And so I think they're getting new, like, so that may have a new life to it because they're getting a new distribution on it. But that, I love that movie. I love that. And we occasionally will, you know, somebody will have a joke referring to that once in a while on the show.
Troy, for our listeners, Tell our audience who Paul Provenza is. There's a lot of comics that you named. These guys are well-known, well-respected amongst their peers, maybe not household names like Dana Gould. How did you get mixed up with that?
Yeah,
that group?
Paul Provenza has kind of become a household name in terms of after his show, The Green Room with Paul Provenza, did 2 seasons on Showtime. And that was an amazing show, and it sort of opened the door. All these other shows started copying it. That's when there's the floodgates open. HBO did a similar version, and there's all kinds of stuff out there now where it's just comics kicking back in a green room scenario. Paul was the first one to actually make that happen on TV and live. He did it for like a decade ago and at the festivals. So Paul not only produced and directed The Aristocrats, he wrote the book Satiristas with Dan Dion, which is an amazing book. If you're into comedy, that is the quintessential book. And he's a dude who gets things done. He is, instead of being focused on the Hollywood rat race, he thinks of it in the same way I do. Just create good projects and then finish them.
You hear that, Chris? Finish them.
Yeah,
that's the hard part. By the way, there's nothing easy about that last part.
No,
the
it's other, true.
The first part easy, because I remember taking a writing class out here from this guy. He used to write for SNL, and he goes, "The problem with us as writers, comics, artists, is not that we don't have enough ideas. We have too many ideas.
Yeah,
And that's, and when he said that, it kind of liberated me. I went, oh, other people have, oh, that's a thing. I didn't realize that's the big curse. We have too many ideas. We just don't act on them.
It's true. I call that the curse of the multi-talented.
Yes.
People that are good at a lot of different things. Maybe you're good at writing. Maybe you're good at stand-up. Maybe you're good at hosting. Maybe you're good at starting a project, producing something. And yeah, you got to stick to something. Listen, let me tell you something. I thank Chris. Chris is somebody who has such a solid work ethic. He keeps me on my toes. He keeps me here. If it weren't for Chris, I probably would have done three of these shows and be like, okay, that was fun. Next.
Exactly. We get bored. There's a little hump we have to go over. Seth Godin is this author, calls it the dip. And it's where you want to quit the project because you're either bored with it or it got really hard and you don't want to go through with the rest of this. It's like, all right, I'm ready for the next thing. But if you go through that dip, then you've got something you can build on. But not until you go through that where you go, let's go on to the next thing. This is getting boring and we've done it. You have to stick with it. That's the only way it's actually going to be get quote unquote finished.
And I think that that's rampant out here, that kind of faulty logic and lack of follow through, because you know, people will be like, hey, you know, I've been taking acting lessons for 6 months. I haven't landed anything. So I'm going to try stand-up comedy. I've been doing stand-up comedy for 6 weeks. I haven't got a paid gig. So I'm going to try improvisation. And you wind up being, I don't want to say a jack of all trades, because that's an insult to people who do a few things well. I mean, you just wind up being mediocre at several different things. I had a girl recently, a terrible comic, tell me, oh, you know, I'm not serious about stand-up. It's just a vehicle for me. And I wanted so badly, if she wasn't so hot, I would have...
You didn't want to sleep with her.
Yeah, so badly. I would have said to her, what on earth do you think you have to offer as a mediocre stand-up comic? Who do you think is going to come along specifically looking for comics who are incapable of putting on a professional show? Like, where do you get the idea that that's an asset to be an open micer?
They want it for the resume benefits. There's a lot of people doing that. And it's just sort of, you know, disgusting to a comic to see someone going, yeah, I'm just up here so, you know, I can put on my resume that I do stand-up. Like, ugh.
Right, but you can't fool people. Stand-up is not something that you can fool people, because if they say, okay, wow, you're a great comic, get up there and do 20 minutes and you can barely handle seven, it's going to be ugly, and it's going to be ugly for you more so than anyone else.
Yeah.
That's why I always feel the need to tell people, like, I don't know why I always feel the need to explain to people, because there are many people who are actors that then go, I'm going to do stand-up comedy. I always tell people, I'm a stand-up comedian that started acting. It's not the other way around, because, you know, like, I don't know, for some reason, I think that gives me a little more validation or vindication or something, that if I could say, no, I'm actually really a stand-up comedian and I act, not the other way around.
Yeah, the culture out here is basically, what can I do to circumvent the work? What can I do to not do the years of hard work it takes to become a respected or accomplished artist?
Yeah, because comics have to work so hard and go through so much shit, going on the road and taking the rejection, then having the bad nights and the drunk crowds. And after a number of years of going through that, you become a polished stone. Like, you have a certain thing about you where you can walk onto a set and act and make it happen right there and then, with even without a script. So for someone to come in and go, oh, so yeah, I heard stand-ups have that ability to do that. I'm going to go do a couple open mics and then say I'm a stand-up, and then, you know, people hire me, because it's a total cheat, and they don't think they're doing that, but they're cheating and they're ruining it for everybody.
Let me ask you, Troy, something you have in common with our resident Chris Z is that you are a self-proclaimed agnostic. Now, you have agnostic in brackets, atheist.
Yeah, I'm an agnostic atheist, and I'm really a hardcore atheist, but I always say agnostic atheist for the reason that that word is very misunderstood. And the fact is that everybody on this planet is technically agnostic, and including atheists. And I think all the atheists that I know would all say, well, yeah, of course, we're all agnostic on a level. We don't know what's out there. No one knows. Like, oh, yeah, no, I got that picture. I saw what's out there. We don't know. But it's really, I think that it's silly to say, well, we don't know, but definitely the Bible, that's just true. I mean, yeah, even though we don't know, so I still say I don't know anything, but I'm also not going to believe the other stuff that people made up.
Well, you've been through fundamentalist Christianity, Scientology, Baha'i. Tell me a little bit about that path, and then tell me how that affects you today as an artist.
It certainly helps everything I talk about. I'm almost obsessed with religion because that's always been my fascination, having grown up in it and then I became more religious than my parents when I was a fundamentalist Christian. I went to a Christian school. I was passionately devoted to the stuff I learned, and I was really into taking down rock music when I was young. That I felt that was satanic.
You mean
evil.
Like playing it backwards and all that?
Yeah, exactly. Backwards masking, as it was called. The secret
sweet,
messages.
Sweet Satan. Yeah.
The secret art on the album covers that hits your subconscious and makes you worship Satan. Yeah. All that stuff I thought was real.
KISS stands for Knights in Satan's Service.
That's
I'm sure
right. That is what someone started. it's like, you know those emails that your parents get that like forwarded, like Republican emails of like, hey, yeah, guess what Obama's doing? And here's a thing. Like, and they're always, you look them up on Snopes and they're always fake, right? All that stuff. That's the, all those things were the, like, there was no Snopes to look up. Hey, does KISS really stand? Yeah. I'm sure we can now look that up. None of that is really true.
What, did you hear about LOL recently?
No.
LOL stands for Lucifer Our Lord. So don't ever write it.
Awesome. Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah, that's the kind of thing that cracks me up.
And that's being taken seriously by parents. These are the same parents who won't let their kids trick or treat.
Yes.
Yeah. And we believe that stuff the same reason we believe religion, because we want to believe it. And maybe it makes us feel better. It certainly made me feel better. So that's why I say, hey, go for it. Believe what you want to believe, whatever the religion is. I did all of them.
Isn't Baha'i is sort of like a distant cousin of Islam, isn't it?
It's related to Islam, but it's they're persecuted and killed in Iran where it was founded.
Because, I know them best for sponsoring stretches of freeway.
Oh, yeah, they do that. Well,
brought to you by Baha'i Faith, this next stretch.
That was the last one I did. That was the last religion I did, and I thought that was the one. I went, oh, this is my one. This is my soulmate religion. Because they're like the Best of God album. They believe in every religion. They take every prophet from every religion and say that they all had a message.
The best of.
It's the best of. But then as it turned out, you know, and you study the Quran and you study the Bible and all that stuff. But it still had the same dogma that every other religion had. It got to a point where I'd say, well, why is that true? And I remember someone going, well, because Baha'u'llah said it. Baha'u'llah is their prophet. Baha'u'llah said it. And I went, oh, that's the wrong answer. That's the I leave now answer. Oh. So what I found was all religions had one thing in common, not just the golden rule, but also that they have dogma inherent in order for them to even continue.
And you would use even Eastern religions in the same vein? Would you say the same about either Hare Krishna or Buddhism? Or
Buddhism,
Taoism.
I wouldn't know, because that's a philosophy and not technically a religion. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could argue it's a religion, but it's actually a philosophy.
So do you think being an atheist has helped you creatively and artistically, particularly as a stand-up?
In every way, and here's how. And the show set list might not have been creative if I hadn't just got to a point of where I realized that belief, we make our own meaning in this world. Some people do it through religion. That's a hand-me-down way to do it, but I respect that if you're not pushing it out in the schools and telling everyone else they have to follow it.
In other words, if you're taking action rather than spouting off at the mouth, which is what 90% of...
Right. If you're trying to enforce it for everybody, that's the problem. But we create our own meaning, which means everything that happens in this world for everybody since humans evolved, we make up that what the world means to us, how we interpret everything. And when you get to that point of realizing on a real true gut level of like, oh my God, we make everything up that we do. Then you have a lot of freedom. Hey, well, why not give people weird topics and have them decide what they mean when they don't mean anything? So everything is informed by that atheism, even though I definitely don't always like to use the word because it's so demonized. But it just simply means I don't want to believe in the stuff that someone else made up. That's what it means to me. That's what atheism means to me. I'm not going to instantly buy into the thing you made up about a guy with a beard who made us in 7 days or anything else like that.
I think I'd be more likely to buy into it if it was in fact made up rather than borrowed from
right.
Other.
It's all, well, I mean, originally made up, but like the story of Jesus is
a hack.
Made
it's
up
downright
a thousand
hack.
Years before Jesus.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's all hack. And it's like, I sort of have a level of respect for Scientology in the way that at least they decided to make up their own new thing. Like that, as crazy as it is, at least they decided they'd make up their own stuff.
Yeah. But the one thing that'll stop you in your tracks if you are, you know, an atheist is when you will encounter adults, people who you formerly considered your peers who will recoil when you suggest that Christianity is no more logical or better or sensible than any other faith. I remember we were having this discussion about Mormonism with a coworker, and he seemed to be pretty familiar with some of its nuances, if you will. You know, some of its the magic underwear, those the glasses. You know, I said, is that really any different from what, you know, Catholics believe or Christians believe, that, you know, he's God, he's one God, but he has a son and a sidekick, and he sent his son on a suicide mission. And this, I mean, when I tell you that he took umbrage, he looked at me like I just asked him if I could fuck his 14-year-old daughter. You know, I mean,
Asked as well.
Which was my next question, but I never got to it because he...
Joseph Campbell had a quote that says, what I believe in is religion, what you believe in is mythology. Something of that.
He said, what I believe in is mythology and you believe in religion. Everything, you know, myths are metaphors, he was arguing, and that religion is just a sort of a misapplied use of mythology, you know, that someone made sacred. Mythology, when it gets made sacred, people freak out and do stupid things. That's now, why it scares me.
What is your medium for voicing your opinions on the subject? Because I did read in your bio that you've apparently spoken at conferences regarding atheism or religion.
I speak at, I do stand up and speak at conferences all over the place really just teaching. I feel like most of what I do is working with people on how to be a civil human being and argue when you're right. And I know that sounds weird, but that's a weird place to be. And Jim Jeffries, great comic, has a joke about, he talks about him being he calls himself an atheist fuckwit. And I was like, wow, that's interesting. And he explains it as when you are in the position that's right, that can be easily like sort of proven that you're in sort of a, you know, you've got a lot of things on your side in terms of evidence, you're a fuckwit. Like, you're not in a position now to have a good conversation with someone because you're always feeling right. And that's a problem. That's an inherent problem of atheism and a problem with atheists interacting with people. They come across as dicks. Or I say we come across as dicks because we're sort of being, quote unquote, right all the time. And that's not a, no one wants to fucking hear it.
Yeah, but I think there is something to be said for an adult who, rather than accept the fact that you are presenting them with concrete evidence and facts, calls you a dick rather than going, you know what, I need to grow the fuck up and start believing in fairy tales.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's true. It is weird, but unfortunately, that's the sort of world we're living in where you have to have a different approach because people instantly shut themselves off and go, no, I'm atheists just are nihilists or whatever. They have a total misconception of what it is.
Yeah, they want to make it, rather than accept the fact that you're an intelligent person, possibly well-read, somebody who thirsts for knowledge, they want to make you out to be some kind of like, yeah, you're just this pompous prick and you probably like, what do you fuck babies? No, I don't. I've never been arrested. I don't.
Do you worship the devil?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I mean, Richard Dawkins put it perfectly. He said, he goes, all of you, he's talking to a group of fundamentalists, he said, you know, you're all atheists about the other 600 gods that have been invented. I just go one god further. And I always like that because, you know, that's just one simple little switch of like, yeah, if I'm an atheist about all these other ones, why not this one?
Go ahead, Chris.
Troy, I did want to, before we forget here, you've got a show coming up real soon, Monday, December 3rd, 9 p.m., the Downtown Independent Theater in downtown Los Angeles. A couple big names in the lineup, Dana Gould, Joey Coco Diaz, Rory Scovel.
Jonah Ray. Yeah, that's going to be a good one.
My God, man. I got to check this out, man. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to see the show before we did the interview today, but it does sound fascinating. And if you ever decide you would like to have a comic that has no credentials in comparison to most of the guys you use, I'm open to the offer.
No credentials. Chris has done comedy in 15 countries.
That's
right.
Oh, I didn't know 15 countries. Wow, that's amazing. Well, let me tell you this. We have every single Friday for the last 2 years, without fail, every Friday except for Thanksgiving, Christmas, we have an open mic
version. For religious reasons.
What's that? Yeah, for religious reasons. We have a set list open show where anybody can go do set list at 5 p.m. at Flappers in Burbank every single Friday. You can just show up. As long as you're there before 5, we've rarely had to turn anyone away.
That's fun. I've never heard of that.
Get your feet wet doing set lists. You get a set list of 4 topics on that show as you get up there. And then you turn around and you act like that's your act. Boom.
Are you there or have you turned this into a franchise?
I host it every time I'm in town. So I'm hosting it later today. But it's going to, when I'm gone, someone hosts it for me.
Great. That sounds great. Listen, we're going to go ahead and move along. Troy, please remain with us. We may ask you to chime in. We're going to go into our next segment, which is Chris's Corner. Nick, hit it, please.
Eight years ago, I secured an audition to be a contestant on the game show network's Lingo. I was instructed to procure a partner. Having been in L.A. less than 1 year, my social circle was a hula hoop. Don was the new guy at work. In a department that is 90% middle-aged Mexicans, it was only natural that two young whittles would gravitate towards one another. I knew nothing more about Don than his name when we paired up. The studio was located on Sunset, just east of the CNN building. Don and I ascended a flight of stairs into a spacious room furnished with picnic tables. The casting director emerged from a door marked private. The game basically consisted of solving a crossword puzzle before the buzzer went off. Teammates were subjected to a short joint interview before playing a mock round. Don and I gave our names, hometowns, and employer. The CD inquired what specifically we did for work. I explained that Don and I were banquet servers, tuxedoed wait staff for weddings and whatnot. The CD then asked what we disliked most about our job. Don reflexively replied, Jewish weddings. What he meant was Orthodox weddings because their use of outside caterers trims our wages. What came across was, the worst thing about our job is Jews. Before I could open my mouth to clarify, Don added, they're a real pain in the ass. While I can't explain away his anti-Semitic sounding remark, I cannot explain why he punctuated it with an expletive. A slight chill filled the room. Don appeared oblivious. And just when it seemed that the worst was over, he huffed, and they never tip. Our previously vocal, energetic fellow auditioneers fell silent. The CD pressed forward, but her tone indicated that she was as put off as the rest of the room's occupants. By that point, I was so flummoxed that I had blanked on the game's rules. I stood there in silence until our time lapsed. Outside the studio, I bid Don an abrupt adieu. I dialed the Lingo hotline as fast as I could. It was late in the evening. My call went unanswered. I left a message fervently apologizing for recruiting a bigoted teammate. My call was never returned. Don and I were not picked to play the game. That's Chris's Corner. Thank you so much.
I don't understand what Don said that was wrong.
The way he said it was unintentional, but you could tell from the sudden quiet, the sudden waxing of energy, the waning of energy in the room that they had construed it, superficially, basically, you know, at face value. Because again, he meant, they didn't understand that though. They didn't understand that when we worked for this specific group, they brought in outside caterers. We made less money. There was a whole lot more work involved for us because we had to set up the room in a certain way, put a curtain down the middle of the room so that the males could be on one side, the females on the other. And again, we got paid less money to do more work, but they didn't know that. He didn't explain that.
So you're telling me that you've never noticed a difference in compensation or gratuities when you've worked for Jews versus non-Jews?
No. You're not understanding, man. Okay. We're not waiters at a restaurant that get a tip on the check. We're paid by our employer. But again, if they're using an outside service, that doesn't raise our rate, and therefore our mandatory 18% gratuity doesn't go up. In proportion to that.
Because I would like to tell you this, my friends, at the risk of being anti-Gentile, I've noticed that when I used to work in the service industry and was employed by either Gentiles or Jews, that the Gentiles were tighter than the Jews.
No. Well, again, in this case, that the comparison doesn't apply because banquet servers aren't tipped like regular waiters. It's part of the contract. If you pay, let's say you pay the Hilton Hotel $20,000 for the function, you multiply an 18% gratuity for the servers, and then that is pooled and divided amongst the server. But if you're only paying $10,000, obviously that 18% is less money and therefore less money to each individual server.
Got it. So it didn't matter what group hired, it would work out the same anyway.
Correct. But in their particular case, because of their dietary restrictions, the kosher, obligations of adhering to kosher, whatever, rules and regulations, our wages were significantly reduced. But again, we still had a lot more prep work to do. And so everyone involved didn't like working them. Don should have thought to explain that a lot better than he did. And again, once he followed that with the end, they never tip. There was no convincing them otherwise. At that point, there was nothing I could do to kind of support him. You know, he had dug his own grave.
But the good news is, if he did not have foot and mouth disease, he might be sitting here today instead of me.
Yeah.
Hey, Nick, let's go ahead and get started with Sal's Weekly Rant. Please hit it. We need rules, people. We've gotten way out of hand. Miss Manners didn't live to see this. Yesterday morning, I sat in the small, warm, quiet confine of the neighborhood donut shop, enjoying a croissant sandwich. I was the only customer. It was just me and the apparent owner, and she appeared occupied. In walks a guy on his cell phone. He remained on his cell phone as he ordered. He got his coffee and walked over to the milk and sugar area. After preparing his coffee, he remained there for what seemed to be about 5 minutes, talking on his phone, talking very loudly. Clear as day, I heard about his real estate property. I heard about the inspection. I heard about the escrow. I heard about his tenants. This asshole made no effort to keep his voice down. Mind you, this wasn't a busy Starbucks, which coincidentally was two doors down. This was a tiny mom-and-pop donut shop. It was me, him, and the owner. It took everything within me not to say, "Hey man, please, you're being very rude. You're ruining my breakfast experience." But I was a visitor that day. I'd only been there a few times over the years and always felt like an outsider among what seemed to be a group of regulars. What if I'm the asshole? Maybe this guy comes here every day. If I should challenge him, perhaps even the proprietor wouldn't back me. After all, I might visit there about twice per year. I sat, with my adrenaline increasing, saying nothing. A few weeks back, I was at the Coffee Bean and Tea Leaf I had just ordered. As I waited, I saw a man talking loudly on his cell phone. He ordered while still on his cell phone, apologizing to his caller. He did not apologize to the barista. I repeat, this asshole ordered his coffee, apologized to the person on the phone, but offered no apology to the coffee chick. This bullshit needs to stop. The problem is, best that I can tell, is no one confronts these assholes. No one approaches them and says, "Excuse me, but what you're doing is rude and ill-mannered." No one challenges anyone. That's it. I'm done. I'm mad as hell. I'm not going to take this anymore. Let's start with rules. Rule number one, the person in front of you, the live person that you're dealing with, the clerk, the bank teller, the barista, takes precedence over the caller. Excuse yourself from the call. Put them on hold. Handle your business, then continue your call. Rule number two, lower your voice. Modern day high-tech cell phones can pick up even a whisper. You don't need to speak even at regular volume. Besides, no one gives a shit about your phone call. No one wants to hear about your personal bullshit. It's never interesting. I vow to say something. Someone needs to say something. I'm getting in people's faces. Prepare for future rants with me either kicking someone's ass or getting my ass kicked. Miss Manners didn't live to see this. Sal's Weekly Rant. Thank you, everybody.
Right on, Sal. I couldn't agree more, man. You know what I think? I think cell phones are a lot like alcohol. If you're an asshole, they help you take it to the next level, man. If you're inconsiderate, they help you take it to the next level. This is the one that gets me, is when you're in line, maybe at the bank, anywhere, and the guy behind you is on a cell phone. Now, if a guy behind me started screaming in my ear, I would turn around and maybe I'd ask him to take it down. Maybe I'd go, "Hey, man, what the fuck is your problem?" But for some reason on a cell phone, people will scream in your ear from 2 feet away, a foot away, and think nothing of it. You get these people who talk on the phone louder than you talk to a normal human being. It doesn't make sense.
You know what I do in that situation is I pick up my phone and I have a loud conversation that sounds incredibly like I'm the other person on their phone, and just until they realize how stupid they are. And I yell just as loud as they do and match their tone. And then they're like, "Who's that annoying person talking loud on their phone?"
Hey, hold on a sec. I got another asshole on the phone here. He's being loud and rude.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, let's get into embarrassing moments. Chris, let's be quick with ours, because I would love to have Troy give us his embarrassing moment. Chris, this is our final segment of the night, embarrassing moments. Go ahead.
All right, so here it goes. Many, many years ago now, I mean, maybe 30 years ago, who knows, roughly, I was at home, and my mother had this bad habit of loving to show, like, family films. Like, just spontaneously, like, "Hey, why don't we watch the video of," you know, thinking that because somebody was our relative, they would want to partake in this. And including but not limited to the video of my birth, me coming out of her vagina, filthy purple, covered in blood and amniotic fluid. And one time she decided to show some footage from when we went to Olong, which is a beautiful beach town in Ecuador. And I wouldn't say a toddler, maybe a little bit more than a toddler, but my stupid brother, who is, I don't know if he was just stupid or inherently cruel, but he loved to tell me things that I was too young to know that he was putting me on. He would, you know, feed this false information to me. One of them is he told me that my penis should always be upright in my trousers. I shouldn't just let it hang. So as a boy of, I don't know, 5, 6, 7, maybe, I got into the habit of reaching into my trousers, standing my penis up,
and which of course naturally, hilarious.
Yeah, gravity would take over, and within seconds it would be right back to the way it's, you know, supposed to hang. So on this video, I had been recorded doing that multiple times, and for some strange reason, nobody thought to mention, "Hey, you got to stop that," you know. So I'm watching this video several years later, surrounded by close friends and relatives. And, you know, I didn't see it coming. I didn't even remember that I had done this for a brief period of time. And in front of everybody, there I was. And I'll never forget the one lady who wasn't related to us, my mom's best friend, Caucasian, so less likely to kind of, you know, keep her mouth shut to keep the peace or whatever. She goes, "What's that he keeps doing? Like, what does he keep sticking his hand down his pants for?" And I think I might have just bolted from the room, if I remember correctly.
How old were you at that time?
I think when I was watching the film, I was now maybe 11 or 12 or whatever. But yeah. And I think what I may have done is in the ensuing years, I went into my mother's closet and I found that tape. And I do believe I destroyed it, though if the movie was not taken by my mother. So there could conceivably be other copies.
That's too bad, because that would have gone viral on YouTube.
That would have totally gone
Thank
viral.
Thank God.
Little boy touches self. Yeah. I'll be real quick with mine. So I used to go to 18 and over clubs. I never got into the 21 and over clubs, but the 18 and over clubs, I had a great time. I used to pick up a lot of these 18 and over clubs. So one time in this instance, it was actually, I believe, in the Inland Empire or Quiet Canyon in the City of Industry or whatever. 50 people on either side in a Soul Train line. And I was trying to impress this one girl named Gloria, who I really had a crush on. Well, it's my turn to go down the Soul Train line. Again, 100 people surrounding me, all looking at me as it's my turn. So I'm booging down the Soul Train line, and I didn't realize until the very end that I had toilet paper on the bottom of my shoe, dragging along a 100-foot Soul Train line. Rest assured, Gloria did not hook up with me. That was my most embarrassing moment. Troy, what do you got for us?
Yesterday at the gym, I was working with my trainer, and he goes, "Okay, I get on this machine." And then as I do, he's like, "Hey, did you know you have dog shit all over your shoe?" And that's an awkward thing, because you're working out, you're at a gym. He goes, "Yeah, I thought I smelled something," which means he smelled shit on me and he didn't even say, "Hey, is something wrong?" He just acted like that makes me think, oh, do I normally smell like shit? And that's just like, this is my smelly client. Let me get him. So it was a little awkward. And then I'm like, okay, I'm going to take off my shoes and just do the workout without shoes now.
Was it was like, this is referring back to Chris's story. Like, is this trainer Latino? That's why he didn't say anything. Or is he was a Caucasian guy? He would have said, "Hey, man, you smell like shit," you know?
My trainer looks exactly like Louis C.K.
Exactly. Physically.
Then he shouldn't
be
training.
Yeah. I mean, he looks like him exactly. It's so weird.
Troy may be the first guy to ever find a trainer who's in worse shape than he is. That does.
Louis C.K. is in good shape, but has the same sort of. By the way, Louis C.K. runs like 5 miles a day or something, 5 or 10 miles every day.
He does.
Like he's in, but he looks like that, like kind of chubby guy, whatever. But no, this guy's like a badass.
If you run 5 to 10 miles a day and you still look like Louis C.K., he must eat like shit. And you know what? I've seen his stand up, and he talks about that. He does eat like shit.
Yeah. He's a fine ice cream.
Yeah, when you eat Cinnabon, you cannot ask for sympathy. Yeah.
No, it's true.
For your parents.
Troy, tell our listeners where they can learn more about you and learn more about the projects you're working on.
Well, the main thing is Setlist, because our TV series airs in the UK, Australia, and Ireland in April. So, but, you know, they'll be able to watch some stuff online. Go to setlistshow.com. I think that's the thing to go to. And that is a revolution in stand-up. So be a part of it early, because you'll be glad you did. It's incredibly different than anything you've ever seen. And it's sort of right now the cutting edge of what stand-up is. And it's the biggest hit at every festival we've gone to around the world.
And nice. Just to be clear, you perform at the UCB, the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater in Los Angeles, with some regularity.
The second Friday of every month for the last just year and a half, yeah.
And the show I mentioned before was the Downtown Independent Theater. That's, I guess, a one-off, a special event on Monday, December 3rd, 9 p.m.
And Chris, tell our listeners where you're going to be.
Ooh, where am I going to be? Tonight's Friday. I'm going to be at the Eagle Rock Comedy Festival.
That's tonight.
That's next Friday.
That's next Friday.
And then I've got and Thursday I should be in... I believe it's Lake Forest, California, performing at a paid gig there. Unfortunately, I can't quite recall what the name is, but I will make sure to plug it on the next show, even though it's the day after.
Nice. Wow. And I will be a guest tomorrow right here at 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, 4 p.m. Eastern Time, a guest commentator on Drew Mark's Bad Advice right here on SkidRowStudios.com. I would like to thank Nick Chacon, our resident engineer. Thank you for being here today. Hope your toe is okay.
Doing good, man. It's all healed up. Antibiotics and surgery. It worked.
Nice. Yeah. And listen, everybody stay tuned to our show, because we got some big news coming up, and we're probably going to
pipeline. Yeah,
yeah, probably going to announce it next week about our show, Skid Row Studios, and the future of everything.
Like us on Facebook. Look me up on Twitter, ChrisZ34,
and I am Sal Los Angeles on Twitter. Troy, do you got a Twitter handle?
I do. It's just Troy Conrad, and then the setlist one is Setlist Show.
Nice. Be sure to check us out.
Of course, we got to thank Orange Dog Music, Wes Hambright. He provides all the music with the exception of the opening theme that we use for our show. Hey, thanks so much for listening. Thanks so much for calling in. We do this every Friday right through the holidays, every Friday from 1 to 2 p.m. Registered Ear Offenders, SkidRowStudios.com.
Nice. And on the 21st of December, we'll be airing our special End of the World show. We all know the end of the world is here, and we're going to be joining you as we bring in the end of the world.
We're going to open up our closets, and skeletons are going to tumble out.
Yeah, we're going to have a special confessions episode, a special End of the World confessions. Hey, everybody, I'm Sal Rodriguez, my co-host Chris Z. I want to thank our guest, Troy Conrad, Registered Ear Offenders. Thank you.